Hello, my name is Tori Whitaker Martinez, and I'm the lead editor for Infection Control Today. And today we have a wonderful group of people, and we're going to be talking about lead aprons. And I appreciate all of you in the panel for joining me today. So, a little bit of a background in operating rooms, catheterization labs, interventional radiology suites, and other procedural areas, lead aprons and th thyroid collars are as routine as gloves or surgical masks. They are essential tools for protecting clinicians from radiation exposure and are worn repeatedly throughout the day by physicians, nurses, technologists, and other members of the procedural team. Yet, despite their routine use, these garments often fall outside clearly defined infection prevention and cleaning standards. In many facilities, responsibility for them sits primarily with the radiation safety programs, leaving hygiene practices inconsistent or undefined. That raises an important question for infection preventionists. Are reusable lead garments truly low risk, or have they simply been overlooked? Even though they don't enter the sterile field, they are worn close to the body, share between staff, and move frequently between clinical areas. So today's roundtable will explore how these items ended up in an infection control gray area, what risks inconsistent cleaning practices may pose, and what best practices should look like for health systems that want to address this gap proactively. So to begin, I want to ask each of you to introduce yourself.
Yes, thank you, Tori. My name is Peter Graves. I'm the CEO of Clinical Solutions LLC, based here in the Dallas, Texas area. My focus has been on perioperative infection control. My background is past AORN board member, past OR director, and kind of infection geek, for a better term.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jill Holdsworth. I've been in IP for a little over 16 years. My current role is Medical Affairs Manager and Infection Preventionist for CS Medical.
Thank you. And Brenna?
Hi, a fellow geek here. My name is Brenna Duran. I am the CEO of Innovative Partners Solutions in San Francisco, California. I have about 12 years of infection experience, and I have been a sole IP all the way up to system director, and I support IP through coaching and also do some consulting work.
Thank you. And Justin?
Thank you, Tori. Nice to meet everyone. My name is Justin McKay. I'm the co-founder of RadCare Services. And I'm in good company as a fellow geek. And when it comes to X-ray garments and lead aprons, I am the king geek. And just meaning that I've studied this topic exclusively for 13 years. And my background, Pete from the OR, was a ortho trauma rep who wore sheared thyroid collars in multiple hospitals. And after acquiring ringworm from wearing sheared thyroids, I started kind of consulting with wonderful people like you from infection control, who helped me a lot and kind of helped me develop a process to really have a best practice solution for hospitals.
Lead aprons and thyroid collars are used daily in ORs and other procedural areas, yet often fall outside formal cleaning standards. How did these items end up in an infection gray area in the first
You
place?
know, Justin, from the standpoint of getting ringworm, I mean, if more people had that problem happen to them, this would be front and center with everybody. And I think that that's one of the big challenges is that, you know, we don't think of it. And Tori, you mentioned very early on as part of this introduction to this program was that they don't enter the sterile field. And I would argue they do on every single case. The only thing is that we sequester them behind a sterile gown. And the problem is that not all sterile gowns are created equal. And that's one of the big problems that we have. Now, when we do have an outbreak, for example, a possible acquired infection or surgical site infections, we don't go back and culture the lead ever. And when we think about radio attenuating devices, you know, lead actually functions much like a personal protective equipment, no differently than our gloves, our gowns, even our lead shields, or even our glasses. So I think one of the big challenges that we have here is that we really need to take it out of the gray zone, take it out of the ozone, for a better term, and bring it to front center, bring it out front. Maureen Spencer and I, we've done several surveys over the last couple of years. And one of the things we do is we go into the operating room and we look at their lead and we find an abysmal. I could show you pictures. I'm sure that everyone here has a visual of what your lead looks like in your facility. But the bottom line is that when we do see lead thrown on the floor, thrown on counters, thrown on over the edge of something, we find, for a better term, sometimes they look pretty gross. And so, they say, well, that's on the outside of the lead. Well, Justin, you had a great example. It doesn't just happen on the outside of your thyroid collar. It can reach out and touch you in a very personal way.
Yeah, it's a wonderful intro. There's a number of measures in place in terms of infection prevention in the perioperative or even the radiological space. And so lead aprons pose just a different, I mean, they traverse the hospital. Some are hospital owned, some are individual or provider owned. There's no real universal protocol or, this state says you should do A, B, and C. And Joint Commission says A, B, and C, but D and V says D, E, and F. And so there really just hasn't been a lot of standardization in terms of the care with these. And so, early on, when I first talked Pete to the first periop and radiology director after I got ringworm, I said, "Hey, what's the deal with these things?" And they said, "Hey, we've got 100 of these. Hey, I've got 1,000 of these. I don't know what to do with these. I don't have the space. I don't have the people, the time. I'm short-staffed. I don't know what to do with them." And so, when you look at the science behind X-ray garments, when 25 X-ray garments were cultured in Michigan by an IR provider, he found 21 of the 25 had Staph A, three of which later confirmed to be MRSA, and 21 of the 25 had ringworm. So what you just said, Pete, hey, they do come in the sterile field. The AORN in 17 published a study in their journal where they polled, I think it was 175 surgical techs, and like 66% of these techs said, hey, these garments are coming into contact with patients every shift. And so we think about garments are quietly carrying pathogens and they're coming into contact with patients every shift. We're kind of setting up a pretty dangerous situation here.
Yeah, and I think that they have really kind of gone under the radar because of a couple things. We generally think about the general public, general folks are going to think about these lead aprons as what the people put on when they kind of stand far away from the x-ray being done, but they still have to have it on for safety. Most people don't understand what happens with a lead apron when it's in an IR procedure or when it's in the OR? So, thinking about how close you are getting to the patient and to the sterile items, the sterile field, and how big of a risk you do have to transmitting whatever is on that. And I can remember in the past when Joint Commission would come, this thing that they would look at with the lead aprons was were they hanging in such a way that they weren't, like overlapping, weren't on the floor. They weren't asking as much about cleaning or at all. They just wanted to make sure that they were hanging correctly. So nothing about cleaning. And in the more recent past, I saw them ask, well, what kind of schedule are they on for cleaning? And we had a paper log that somebody wrote something down on, but how are they cleaned? What were they cleaned with? Did somebody just kind of casually wipe it, or did they just mark down on the log that, yeah, we did it because we have to keep this log because my manager said so? I don't think that the why has sunk in yet to everybody. And that's what I think we have to really get out there, the why. Everything else that goes into the room must be cleaned when it comes out of the room. Unless it's thrown away, which we don't want to throw these away. But why have we overlooked lead aprons? Why is this not being disinfected when it comes out of the rooms? And honestly, I don't know. I don't have the answer because this seems like a huge vector for transmission that literally has just been overlooked. And don't get me started on the ED. If you think about the lead in the ED, I think it's even less on someone's radar that, oh, we could be transferring everything. The ED is the first stop for everybody. And we rarely think about cleaning things in the ED, but this is kind of like a hotbed for the ED if you have lead aprons down there.
I love that you say that, Jill. And what comes up for me is I actually had an opportunity to go down this rabbit hole We actually went through this. We came up with a cleaning process. And the two things that really stuck out. One, sometimes these pieces of lead belong to an individual person. They are dedicated, they're embroidered, they belong to someone. Their ownership, do they belong to the provider? Do they belong to the hospital? Has been a barrier. You know, what belongs to whom? The other side of that is, what do you clean them with? I think we can all agree, while we love bleach on everything as much as possible, bleach is obviously not a good idea. But do you use, you know, your basic disinfectant wipe? And then the other side of that is, does using a disinfectant wipe to clean or wipe down these leads, does that damage the material that's covering up the lead? And then the last part of that is also, what do you do when there's a tear or a rip? So what's the role there? I'm really looking forward to this conversation and kind of walking through, you know, how we might approach this and support people. But from my perspective, you look at it and you simply don't know what to do with it. And since no one's actively saying we have to do something about it, it feels like it becomes a tomorrow problem.
I am blown away that we're even saying, like, does somebody need to say you must clean something that went into a room, became dirty and came out? We shouldn't even have to make a statement about a singular item because we've already kind of made that blanket statement. You know, it comes out of the room, it needs to be cleaned. We cannot, as an industry, say, like, you know, call out every single individual item and say, you know, this pin came out of the room, so we need to disinfect it, or this item came out. We know that things that come out need to be disinfected. So again, it is a little baffling that these have kind of skated by the normal processes in infection prevention.
You know, you brought up an interesting point earlier when you spoke, Jill, about, you know, you can't throw them away. Well, I've seen some that I would like to throw away because they were gross. And I don't mean to kind of make this kind of, you know, a little funny, but it really is sometimes gross. And I think to your point, Brenna, is that you really do have to go back to, I for one, as an OR manager, director, I really don't care who owns the device. It's going into my patient room. And so that patient is a shared responsibility to everybody. So for me, as a nurse, as an advocate for patient safety, then I'm going to always err on that side of safety. Now, how you set up your policies and procedures on how to clean, when to clean, how often you clean, where do you log it when you clean? That's really going to be kind of an individual manufacturer's, you know, follow the manufacturer's written instructions on how to clean. I've been into hospitals where they had scrubbles, you know, the spray on that you can use a brush with, or with a surf, you know, a soft cloth to be able to remove both the stains or whatever. On the fabric, it doesn't really matter to, you know, whatever the manufacturer's recommendations are, follow them. But I think it goes back to competencies, having clearly defined roles, responsibilities, and competencies, making sure that you have this. Now, I for one used to, in an effort to try to avoid some of this, I had every staff members, I ordered them their own leads, their own aprons, their own, and they were all embroidered. And what I wanted them to do is have ownership, kind of like having a car. You want your car to look good. I wanted them to make sure that their leads look good. Now, I know that's not possible in all places because the Wild West down in the ER, you don't have that luxury. You do in a cath lab where you're going to have Dr. X or Y always in there. You're going to have the same team always in there. In the orthopedic room, you did ortho trauma, Justin. You're going to have similar teams in there all the time. We're always going to be in lead, and we're going to be sweating underneath that lead. No matter how cold it is in the room, we have a gown on, we have lead on. Those leads are heavy. You know, we're imparting all of this into the sterile field, and this is why we really do need to take a more proactive, take it out of the gray zone, ozone, and put it front and center to everybody's attention. Aorin did a really nice job in their 20 in their most recent edition of care of the environmental care about defining that every they need to be cleaned, they need to be logged, and so on.
We do 800 pieces a shift right now, and I have been doing this for 13 years. So, what I'll tell you is this: regardless of the state you're from or the size of the hospital you're from, when garments arrive, they are in a shipping container. They are sealed in a liner inside the container. And still, Pete, when you walk by the shipping dock with a first-time customer there, you can smell the garments through the shipping container. Some of our labor positions in the back who are physically working on these garments, they laughingly have a dry heave counter on their whiteboard in the back where they make fun of one another because of what they see and smell coming off of the garments. The gross factor is real. And what a lot of people kind of assume, by the way, that kind of talk about flying under the radar, people have told me in the past, hey, our garments are fairly new and we don't really need to worry about cleaning these because they're fairly new. And again, this is just a awareness piece. I've been in the manufacturing plants every year for a decade. I know the larger players, the smaller players. I know who's making what with what core material. And walking their manufacturing plants, I'll tell you, garments aren't made in what you call a clean environment. And when you think about, pharmaceuticals or healthcare being, manufacturing implants in a clean environment, X-ray garments are manufactured in an open air, open window. I've got no gloves on, and Pete, I'm sewing these things together, and Brenna's checking her iPhone and having a sip of her Diet Coke, and then she slings it in a cardboard box, and 10 people have touched it, and it shows up at your place, it gets unpacked, and it gets moved right into a sterile environment because it's assumed to be clean. And I can tell you from doing ATP testing pretty rigorously on brand new garments, there's concerns there too.
I'm curious, hearing this conversation, I just think of what it took just to get buy-in at the hospital I was at to get some focus and some resources around just the OR. I feel like as infection preventionists, we can make a reasonable argument that the OR is really a protected almost, we want to keep it as clean and as functional for our patients as possible. Outside the OR, I feel like it becomes more problematic. So, if you were speaking to hospital leadership, and let's just say we start with the OR, what is your elevator pitch? How do you get buy-in for hospital leadership to just maybe start there?
Just speaking to the perioperative space. Initially what I share is, so the AORN, like Pete said, and their recommendations every year they put out, they specifically talk about high touch objects and high touch surfaces and how you should have what they call a scheduled clean and enhanced cleanings. So, your walls and floors and ceilings, they get deep cleaned probably quarterly. In between that time, they want you doing something proactively. So if I got a 60-second window with Pete and he was an OR director, and I just said, hey, Pete, here's the deal and here's what we're doing. We're talking about HAIs and SSIs, 100,000 patients dying every year from an HAI. Hey, we have protocols that we can share. Or Brenna, you were asking earlier about recommendations. We have protocols that we can share from other institutions who have implemented and kind of revised their practices, where they've incorporated scheduled deep cleans plus the use of wipes. And Brenna, your question earlier about the wipes, I warned you I was a geek. I've got an entire PowerPoint dedicated to wipes. And the indications and contraindications from the garment manufacturing companies. And so really, in fairness to Pete, if he was an OR director, Pete, you're short-staffed, you got a lot of things going on. Maybe I was a little unfair earlier when I said, hey, no one's really paying attention to this. The AORN did a study where they reached out to all the manufacturing companies and they really couldn't get a good answer. Hey, buy my wipe. Hey, use my spray. Hey, I don't know. And then when you look at the list of contraindications, don't fold them, don't crease them, no UV light, no sunlight, no extreme heat, no extreme cold, no alcohol, no bleach. Someone in Pete's shoes in that scenario is like, my gosh, what do I do here? I've got 1500 of these things. I don't know how to do this. So, if I got 60 seconds with Pete, I would say, hey, I've been doing this for a decade. I've got references from AORN roundtable members or board of director members. And really, we have a lot of science I would share. ATP data, before and after photos from other networks. So oftentimes it boils down to a picture being worth a thousand words. And so when a garment shows up and it's got a broken buckle and it's got a torn strap and an ATP test at 20,000 RLUs, then it comes back at zero, with documentation and it's been tagged and recorded. The light bulb kind of goes off that, wow, okay, there's probably a better way we could be doing this.
As an IP, I feel like we all intrinsically get it, right? Really, what we struggle with is the how. Like, how do we do this? And, IPs trying to figure out a validated process, trying to work with the IFUs. I read recently that it can cost up to $100,000 just to go through the validation process to approve a singular disinfectant on something. How would you both propose helping IPs, sell the how? And get support to move forward on these processes.
That's a great question. So I would just want to kind of circle back to something Justin mentioned earlier. For infection preventionists, there is no 5-second rule, okay, when something drops on the floor. I can't tell you, Justin, you've seen it before, lead ends up on the floor. All right, there's no 5-second rule. All right. So, that's kind of our geeky term, like if it hits the floor, it needs to be like cleaned. All right. We know how dirty the soles of shoes are. We should consider the same thing for our lead. Now, for me as a OR leader, past OR leader, one of the things I would say is you got to make it personal. You got to bring the story home. And there's 100 competing issues for every OR leader every day, whether it's Dr. X, Dr. Y, Sally, John, whoever it might be. There's 100 different competing interests. And now you're bringing something that's not on their radar to them. And you want to make this a number one priority in their day, in their week, in their month. So I think one of the things that you have to do is, we have cultures. We have ATP. Go and culture some of their do an internal investigation. It doesn't have to be published. You can do it for a quality improvement project. You don't need an IRB to do this if you're not going to publish it, but you can kind of determine how big the problem is. I can remember talking to infection preventionists when I was on the industry side, and they were, we're talking about, have to do laundry and do, la and the cuffs of their white lab coats are black because they hadn't laundered their own lab coats. So, you look at this and you kind of think about, okay, how do I make this personal? And I think this is one of the big challenges that we have because we don't have the time, we don't have the resources. There's a lot of things we don't have, but we do have is the passion to try to make sure that we don't have a bad outcome for a patient. Now, I had both hips replaced. The last thing I wanted, and I knew they were going to have lead in there. Last thing I want is some gross looking lead separating me from the sterile field by some polypropylene. And I don't want that for my patients. I don't want that for my family members. I don't want that for your families. So I think we just need to make this personal and bring it home. We all have pictures, all right? Either a visual picture or of something on our cameras or whatever it might be. Bring it home to them and show them this is what I'm seeing. And whether you're an infection preventionist with a clinical background or an MPH, it doesn't really matter. What you're doing is really helping change the behaviors within the operating room.
Brenna, yeah, you're spot on there, Pete. And Brenna, you said, hey, how would we help or how would we coach or support IP in that conversation? And usually what I love to do is work with IP. Sometimes they call it infection prevention, sometimes it's infection control. Sorry if I get IP and IC interchanged. But what I love to do as an ally or a resource there is let me get five or six pieces. Let us do the data. Let us take some photos. Let us ATP. Let us document. and build you a before and after report. And that way the IP professional then says, wow, look at these. They smell good. They look good. They've been repaired. Here's the data on them. It really helps in that conversation. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, that IP and I have had to strategize together just to get the awareness attention it needs. And Pete, I learned ATP from an infection control director in my early days. And I'll never forget going into one of my first meetings, Pete, OR director, and I stopped at the gas station. Gas pump handle I thought was gross. And so just for fun, I ATP'd it, you know, took a picture of it. And, you know, I was the weirdo guy at the gas station, ATP in the gas pump handle.
There's hope for you, by the way.
Yeah. And then I went and sat down 45 minutes later, and the OR director said, I've been doing this 30 years, and I've always had concerns about lead, but no one's making me do this. And so why would I invest my budget dollars into this when it's not a requirement, and I'm not being forced to do it? And I closed the laptop, and I said, let me have a bunny suit. I said, let's go back and let's follow right now. Your lead tech, your busiest provider, let's do some live ATP spot. Went back there, ATP'd. It was 9 times dirtier than the gas pump handle. And legit, it wasn't until I met infection control and started having conversations there and sharing that data, and infection control said, oh goodness, like we cannot, you know, we have to take, Pete, you're right. There's so many things you're tasked with as an OR director. But when infection control sees the data, infection control says, I can't sleep at night. Like, we've got to do something here.
But you made that personal.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
What that does is it changes the priority of that. And you bring it, you know, to me, you brought it out front instead of it's stand in line behind me.
Yeah, and good call. Good call.
So I think that's an important aspect of this, and I would challenge all of you. You know, we did a study way back when looking at home laundered versus, you know, hospital provided scrubs, and we found similar issues. We even found fungi on disposable scrubs. You know, because to your point, you know, they're produced in open air factories and so on. So this is one of the big challenges that we have, not just with LEDs, but with any of the fabric, woven fabrics, and so on. So I think this really kind of comes full circle for me. Is like, you know, one of the challenges we have is, you know, we use Spalding classification for semi-critical, critical, those type of things. But Tori, you mentioned earlier about some of this stuff kind of falls into the gray zone. We don't think of lead in the Spalding classification whatsoever, and we should, you know, because it's entering into a sterile environment. And, you know, we really need to kind of change the whole paradigm in and around this whole topic in order for it to become more center.
You know, what bothers me most about what Justin just said was the fact that
everything
the guy said he knew and had been worried about it, but didn't do anything about it because it came down to money.
Yeah.
And that infuriates me. Because I don't want to bring in politics, but I will say that in Europe, in the UK, I bet they don't worry about it there.
Yeah. And Tori, you're spot on there. And you know, I was recently asked, our first 2 years of business, for example, you know, we're the first full solutions provider. And so think about it. My first 2 years, I was traveling to AORN, APIC, and I was educating and just talking and just trying to facilitate some discussion. And so in transparency, as a business owner, you know, my half, almost 2 years, I didn't get a paycheck. And we had a baby coming, had a baby on the way. I just bought a bigger home. And people kept saying to me, well, 2 years into this, like, hey, like, are you sure about this? And I said, I've been behind closed doors. I know what needs to happen here. And so when I hear from someone, yes, I know that these are a concern. Oh, but you know, we can't afford it. And Tori, what you just said, I'm just sharing personally with you. It lit a fire in me that's still 12 years later rolling, because listen, you know, there was a lawsuit in Evansville, Indiana, where seven people got cancer in 5 years, two providers passed away. And a lot of commentary about decrepit lead and lead not being clean and lead not being repaired and lead being so nasty that people didn't want it to touch their skin. So they weren't wearing thyroid collars correctly. And so hear of lawsuits and deaths and all the stuff. And a hospital system tells me we can't afford it, or we don't have the money, or we had a down year last year. And I'm like, no, 100,000 patients die every year from HAIs. And I don't want to hear that we can't afford this. You know, it's, we can do better. And so what I've been lovingly saying, you know, hey man, the Joint Commission has this thing about zero harm. And they say, look at your protocols, look at your practices, think outside of the box, do something new, do something you've never done before.
I love that you're taking that approach. Again, I'm just kind of sitting in this IP space where, you know, when we have a surgical site infection, when there are HAIs, you know, we are tasked with finding out what's the smoking gun, you know, what caused this HAI, you know, what could we have done better? And I'm also just reflecting on the fact that if I, you know, go back in my head to all of these lead aprons, they're not white. These thyroid collars are not white. They're not a beautiful light shade of blue or yellow. They're very, very dark colors. And as, you know, a clinician, you know, you visually inspect. Well, the reality is if you're visually inspecting these items, you don't have a clear representation of how dirty they are. And when we're looking for smoking guns, I can't imagine there have not been an array of surgical site infections that have been seeded from a dirty apron. And so I think also, you know, as IPs, when we're continuing to look, you know, what else do we need to look at in this environment? What fomite or what contamination might be brought into the space? You bring up an excellent point. And the last thing I'd really love to say is we can all bring pictures, share pictures on our iPhones. Oh, look, you know, look at my lead apron cabinet. But really doing the ATP testing of your top providers, you know, the surgeons that are you know, the most well-renowned, the ones that are the most meticulous about how they really providing that information to those providers, say, this is how dirty your lead apron is. That may very well be a recipe for how IPs can get the buy-in needed to help move this initiative forward. So thank you so much for sharing that.
And I think that's a good point you bring up, Brenna. You have to be a little bit sensitive to how you approach it. I mean, you can't come in swinging, but you have to come in trying to find the problem and a solution to the director, provider. And I think that's a really important, you know, if you, you know, come with data, because data drives your program. You know, that's a big issue here. And so if we don't know, we're swinging for the wall, but we're happy if we get an infield hit, since we're going into baseball season. So I think one of the big things that we have to think about is, you know, how are we going to, you know, assess this? And I would encourage everyone listening to us today, go into your IR, go in interventional radiology, into your cath lab, into your OR, go into your ER, and take a look at your lead. If you have the resources available, you can do ATP testing. It's relatively inexpensive and it's quick, and you get some, and look, ask the questions, talk to the clinicians, ask them, how are they inspecting their lead? Are they doing it before every single case? How often are they cleaning? Get that baseline information so that you can help them with training. You know, every department typically has at least a monthly meeting or huddles or whatever it is. Make a point to come to that and share the information. And you're going to have to go back a month after month after month. Put this on your calendar as a to-do, to so that you can bring this to the forefront, bring this out front to them so that they know that what they're wearing can be a problem. To your point, a fomite is a significant issue, but put it in terms of, it could be a hot, you could be posing a risk for infection to your patients. And I think this is one of the big challenges. Nobody wants to be that person. All right. And it's not just a nerve, it's not just a circulator problem or a provider problem. It's a surgical tech problem. It's a team problem. And it's an us problem. And this is one of the big challenges that we have to overcome, particularly in the long term.
Who should be required to do this? Is it the person who's wearing it? The person who just took it off? Is it EVS? Is it the radiology people? Is it IP? Who is it?
Well, first of all, I think it starts with the individual. I'm wearing this, it should be clean. So if it's clean, I should clean it before I wear it. Now, that means that I need to clean it, let it dry before I wear it. But again, if I take it off, I should clean it, make sure it's next time I wear it. Particularly if it's my personal lead, then I should have ownership. I use the term like a car, keep your car clean. Take care of those things that take care of you, I think is one of those kind of mantras that I've always taken. I do it at home. I preach to my kids all the time. Look, take care of your car because you don't want it to break down on the side of the road. So it's no different for your lead. Your lead needs to make sure there's no tear, stains, and so on. You need to make sure that the lead is not broken, whatever it might be. And remember, it's not necessarily lead, PB. It could be a variety of different substances that they use, part of the radiation attenuation device. And remember, it's not just the lead that you wear or the collars you wear. It can also be the bonnets you put on your head. It could be the eyeglasses you might be wearing. It could be even X-ray gloves. Now, the nice thing is that if I'm in surgery, I should be wearing radiation attenuation gloves that are disposable, not reusable, because those lead gloves are like wa wearing welding mitts, and you can't feel anything. Okay, so the same thing applies to your shielding that you're going to be using in your specialty areas. So you need to make sure that's clean. Now, just because I put a cover over it, like in an IR lab where I'm bringing one of those plastic, like a sterile trash bag that has the elastic at the top, it doesn't free me from the requirements of making sure my environment is clean. And so I think one of the challenges that we have, and I think Justin and Brenna, you've all experienced this, Tori, you as well, is that when we have to deliver unfortunate news that you have the grossest, lead aprons this side of the Mississippi, then it's a little easier to take that this is how we're going to fix this. This is how we're going to remedy this problem. This is how we're going to, manage this problem long term. And I think this is one of the challenges that we have.
Pete, the ownership piece is great. And see a lot of perioperative directors who do that. Hey, I'm going to buy everybody their own thyroid collar. And I'm going to hope that he or she will take a little better care of it because I made that investment for them. Love that. Support that for sure. The only thing that made me to piggyback or also think about when Tori said is, hey, who should be responsible for this? I love the ownership piece, but I do think, interdisciplinary committee at the hospital level needs to be setting a protocol in place that, that radiology and cardiology and surgery and endo and pain management and all across the house are aware these are our new best practice protocols. Pete, you say we've all seen these, nasty garments, but month after month, the grossest, most nastiest pieces that we ever laid eyes on are usually provider-owned pieces. And the providers are generally the ones that say, you're not taking my lead, it's my lead, and it's not dirty, and I'm the only one that wears it, and I'm your best provider. Let me flex my muscles for you. I love it when a provider says, you can't have my lead for 48 hours, because I just talk to the director, I wait till he or she goes on vacation, I get him a shipping label, and something comes in looking like that thyroid collar. That's a cardiology provider. It looked like you'd smeared peanut butter on the inside of the thyroid collar. And the guy said, oh, it's my lead. I'm the only one that wears it. Hey man, that's gross. Do you wash your own gym socks?
When I encountered this in the hospital I was at, from an IP perspective, observation, I feel is a fabulous way to start. Approach this from a place of curiosity. take time to really understand the processes, who's in charge of what, what departments are involved. And then absolutely either, take this to your infection prevention department, take this with to your medical directors, have a broader conversation about how you can approach this. And I have found, as an IP, piloting things is often a way to kind of get the foot in the door and get some buy-in and checking out a process. And so we were able to do that again with our OR, and actually we're able to walk, what happened to our lead, who touched it, what was owned by providers, what was owned by the hospital, and able to come up with a process to disinfect and clean these pieces of lead, while ensuring all of the important and vital stakeholders were included. And this wasn't something that occurred overnight, and we did all start off small and build from it. But again, approaching it from a place of curiosity and taking the time to know the players and the processes is vital, because then you know who to go to get that buy-in and support, to make this process a reality.
I think one of the things that, Justin, you mentioned earlier, there's a boatload of studies out there that talks about this. One that I kind of liked is by Jane et al. And it's in 2019 Journal of Infection Prevention, and it's X-ray bacterial presence on lead X-ray aprons utilized in the operating room via IBIS and standard culture methods. And, to your point, that you talked about, MRSA, MRSE, just about every under the sun that you can find in these X-ray aprons. Are you going to tolerate that in your facility? And I think everybody on this call would agree that we're not. And so if you're armed with that knowledge and you have documentation that shows that, we've known about this for years and years. It's indefensible at that point. And so I think then we have, to your point, Brenna, that you talked about earlier, is that we have a duty to act. And so I think, as an OR leader, we all want to make sure if we do no good, we do no harm. And so I think that, to me, is kind of a marching order that I've always kind of walked to, whether I'm in pre-hospital care or I am in doing neurospine procedures. We want to make sure that we give that patient the best opportunity. And I think that all of us want to walk away from here, from this conversation, knowing, yes, there's a problem. I don't think anybody would say that there's not. I know that there's personalities. Yes, there are. Some strong, some not so strong. But at the end of the day, we're here to make it a safer environment. And to me, that's kind of the takeaway that I have as a OR person. Yeah, I have a whole lot of other competing events, competing topics in line for my attention. But now I need to make sure that I make this a priority for my team as well. And this is not an individual issue. Yes, to your point, Brenna, as an IP, you do have to go out there and kind of, beat the bushes and look. But now, where we have the rubber meet the road, we have to make sure we are making sure that everybody is buying in on this. And that means everybody on the team. That includes those who own their own attire, their own lead. Their physician provide, I don't care how good they are, they can cause infections just like a junior surgeon can. So I think this is one of the challenges we have. So again, make this personal, make it a priority, make it a team event.
Pete, my radical idea here, my radical vision, in terms of changing the dynamic or changing the conversation inside of hospitals, is this. Why do hospitals want to own and manage lead garments? Why do they want that liability on their hands? And what I mean there is Pete, I've had a couple conversations with two different hospitals, and this is where I've been kind of crying in my beer to my infection control friends. I've approached a couple different hospitals, and I've said, "Why do you own lead? Half of it doesn't fit. Half of it you don't use. Someone's left. You still got it. You're passing it around. No one cleans it. It doesn't get repaired. You don't know what to do with it. It's a hassle." And so two different networks, I've said, why don't, like, for example, I own the lead for you. And it's like, you know, your linens or your scrubs or what, you know, CentOS. You know, they come to your facility, they pick up, you know, 300 whatever, and they drop you 300 clean, fresh ones there. And so, like, why do hospitals want the liability and the ownership of these garments? So at two different hospitals, both times, they said, this is really interesting. And this really makes sense. And if I need smalls this month, and then next month I need a 3X, I can just swap them out with you. I don't have to buy another set for $1,000. And so both times I started getting the ball down the field in conversations, the mindset still, as you all know, Pete, you've been managing OR personalities for a long time. Hey, no. I need to have my alma mater and I want to pick my colors and I want hearts and teddy bears. And so literally I had these department heads saying, yes, we can do blue for radiology and we can do red for surgery and we can standardize all of this. And the few voices who really dug their heels in because they wanted to choose their fabric or they wanted to choose their color. Like it was that powerful of a vote that conversation got squashed. So that's on my whiteboard and corner for sure. I haven't given up that dream yet. But I just think it'd be so much easier for hospitals if they didn't even have to own the garments in the first place.
I mean, that's what linens do. I mean, I've had so many conversations over the last 2 years about linens and about how much cheaper it is.
Yeah.
They don't have to worry about it. It comes in clean. And you know what? And if they want to have their little logos on there or whatever, I'm sure there's something that you could do about it. Maybe they have...
Put them on Velcro.
Yeah, something. I mean, for God's sakes, really? You can't live that long without your logo?
Yeah.
I mean, let's be serious here. I mean, especially if you're in the operating room, who's going to see it anyway?
I think that's totally valid, but also it's people that we're talking about. And these kind of cultural shifts take time.
Yeah.
And from a provider's perspective, you know, they might be thinking this is just one more thing that I have to give up in order for you to save a dollar. So I think part of this conversation is how do we present this and communicate this in a way that they see the value, but they don't feel like they're giving up something to get something.
Yeah.
Well, I think the fact that, you know, you have all this data, Justin, on attire, you know, or lead, not attire, but lead, which is technically still attire. It would be interesting if you have, for example, if you had a break of staph epidermidis infections in your total hips or total knees, go back and culture their lead.
For sure.
See if
you can trace it.
See if you get an organism.
Yeah.
And I think when you start doing that, that becomes real. And I think we need to see more of that. I haven't seen much in the literature. I did a lit search before this call earlier today, and I didn't see anything that was really calling out specifically that traceability. But I think, you know, that's where we need to kind of take this. If we're having problems in your institution, or if you're having a group of hospital acquired infections, and it's in a facility where the docs refuse to cover their beards or they are having other issues. A lot of things that you have to look at. Oftentimes, because the lead is in another closet somewhere, we don't look at it. We don't look for it. We don't see it like we would if I'm looking at you, Brenna, or looking at you, Tori, or Justin. You know, I think that's one of the big challenges that we have, is that out of sight, out of mind, so therefore it's not a problem. But we need to do that full 360 on this as well.
If regulation in your facility is not prescriptive yet, what would the best practice look like for these healthcare systems that want to get ahead of this problem? Assuming they do, but I'm going to assume that they do.
Well, for me, as I was running an imaginary OR right now, I would say I would make sure that I would mandate my team to clean after every use and to log it daily. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen, and compliance will become a problem. And then I don't want to be that nag, but at the same time, I want to make sure that I'm providing the best services to my customer, my patient. So again, I would look at situations like, how often are these leads being used? I would make sure that they're being tested appropriately, that they're inspected at least weekly. I would round on them just like when I rounded in my rooms. I'm checking for hand hygiene. I'm checking for all this. I'm also looking for this as well. I would add that on my monthly or weekly, daily rounds to make sure if I'm seeing lead, I'm going to pick it up and put it on the hanger. I want to make sure that if Dr. X or Dr. Y is having, their own lid and they're throwing it on the ground, then I'm going to call Justin and say, kind of, hey, bring your ATP and your peanut butter in here, because I think it's important for, yeah, that was kind of gross, Justin. Okay, just saying. But come in here and test. I want to know what my problem is. And this is where, Brenna, I was kidding with Justin, but it would really be you and me talking on a daily basis. Now, when I was at my previous facility, my best friends were infection prevention and safety. I had them all the time. I had them on speed dial because I wanted to make sure that we were indispensable partners. I am just as important to this process as is, and Brenna is just as important as I am. We're not any better or worse. We might bug the crap out of each other from time to time, but that's important. And so I encourage everyone listening to this. If you're not partnering closely with your OR and IP people, that's a problem. Get out of your office, get together, have coffee, do something, round, work together on a daily, weekly basis.
I'm just thinking the reason why we identified our lead was because of the relationship that we had cultivated with our OR team. And just looking at the fact that there wasn't enough space to hang the lead and the lead was on the ground. And so how do we solve this opportunity? And so I think to your point, yes, take your IPs out to coffee, boba, one, sweet treats. I mean, we're pretty flexible. IPs look at their roles as the opportunity to blend best practices with reality. So our job is to try to help find the way to make it happen. But we need your, operational expertise. We need to understand your barriers. We need to understand what those limiting factors are in order to co-create it. My expertise is meaningless without your input. And your input, while incredibly valuable, is really challenging to execute without our input as well. So I just really love that. And I think of all the relationships I've built with my OR and SPD partners over the years and how I still text them regularly. So thank you for that. And absolutely, Justin, I want to hear what you have to say too.
No, spot on. I'm right there with you. I'm in your corner. You're driving the motorcycle, I'm riding the sidecar. And what I mean there is, Pete, I come alongside OR, I come alongside infection control. And when I use the word disciplinary early or multi-faceted committee, that's where change and culture, that's where protocols are made and improvements are made. But so we started initially with a cleaning process, and cleaning was our cornerstone for a couple of years. But over the last decade, the lack of governance on these garments, and just the, like you said, Pete, I got 1,000 things on my brain every day, has kind of led us the last decade to evolving into a true management partner. Meaning, so Brenna's like, hey, we don't have space, we're a little short. I'm going to come in, we're going to talk about racks, we're going to talk about proper storage. I'm going to share protocols with you from other networks where IP has driven that committee. And they've got a scheduled clean in place where the garments are being deep cleaned either on a quarterly or a semi-annual basis. Pete, to your point, they're being wiped down and inspected in between those scheduled cleans. Garments aren't protecting someone if they're not fitting them properly. And so in terms of what would best practices look like, Tori is just coming alongside leadership and saying, hey, let's build the program together. I've never, you can ask anyone I know or work with, I've never said this, this, and this is how we're going to do it. I say, hey, here's what other networks are doing. and this is working well for other networks, this hasn't worked so well. So you present options to those folks and allow them internally, because, and think about it, people, in my opinion, people best support what they help to create. And so you're a facilitator. And, you know, when you're a geek who's been doing this for 13 years, like, it allows me to come in with Brenna or with Pete and say, hey, this is something I know really well. Let me give you some insight.
And I'd like to know what your final thoughts are.
Being an OR person, this is not always on the front of my radar. You know, this is like I mentioned a couple of times, there's a lot of competing interests for my time and attention. But we have to do better. And I think for me as an OR person or somebody that goes in to do surveys, it's something I always look at. And if it's not on your radar, it should be. And we have to do better. We don't look, Brenna mentioned this earlier, we don't look when we have an outbreak that we should. I think if anything, this might get more attention to, more time and attention to this very, very big and unmet need of focusing on the quality of what our protective devices are that we wear to protect us from ionizing radiation. And I think it's no different than wearing your badge and changing out the badge every month, you know, to know what our dosimeter is. You know, we have to know what it is that's on our personal protective equipment, just like we would if we're having a sterile field in the back table. We want to make sure we do no harm, that we only do good. So make sure that your staff is cleaning. Make sure your staff is inspecting. Make sure your lead is hung up correctly. You know, when I started thinking about this and hearing both Jill and Brenna and Justin talk about this, it kind of grossed me out, to be honest with you, as an OR nurse, because everything's supposed to be clean. And if it's not, we have to do better.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking about, you know, a couple of bed aprons that we've looked at and didn't know if it was blood or iodine. Thinking through, you know, how do we determine which is which, and like, what do we do with that? And like, what does it mean if it turns out being, you know, bodily fluid? And then from there, I think about, you know, pictures are great. CP is great. But what really needed is somebody listening to this saying, you know, I would really have to spend some time and energy to actually do some cultures and some PCR and see if we can actually make an epi link between some of our, you know, MRSA or our Staph aureus SSIs and some of our lead aprons. I would really love to see someone take that on, because I feel like it's just challenging to make that true connection between cause and effect without it. And so that would be what I would hope to walk away. And then from there, I would love there to be a playbook that IPs can go to and say, okay, this is what we need to consider. These are things that, you know, other IPs have done. This is kind of how they've approached it. And really giving IPs they can utilize to put this into action versus all the time that it takes to kind of research and frame it out and get support and get buy-in, because it's so much easier to do something that someone else has done that's been successful than it is to try to create a wheel on our own.
And if I could jump onto one thing that Brenna just said, I love the idea of a playbook, but it needs to be synergistic. And so you need to make sure you're partnering with your IR people, your radiology people, you're talking to your OR staff, the ER, all of these folks need to have a say, and don't just bring in one view. It needs to be multifocal.
I love to be a resource, okay? And anyone that knows me knows that relationships are everything, and relationships above everything for me as a person. And so there's networks that I've consulted with for 2 years and 3 years. And you read the culture, you read the people, and you read the room with how you develop trust and rapport and respect. Business comes on its own. And so for me, when Brenna says, I need a playbook, I need someone to attend a meeting with me, I need someone to kind of help coach me past this objection or past this hurdle, man, that's what I love to do. And so for me, like my takeaway or my encouragement really from this call was, wow, this community of infection control is one that I haven't really known how to get connected with. And for me, when I know I'm going into a meeting with six directors and I say, who's inviting infection control? And sometimes I go into meetings and infection control is not there. And I'm like, oh man. And then when I go to that meeting and infection control is there, and I'm talking about kill ratio, or I'm talking about microorganism replication and doubling times and doubling factors, infection control person, he or she is going, yes, yes. And so from a collaboration standpoint, I'm thankful for this time, and I'm encouraged to be talking to your membership just because, like Pete said, hey, there's a lot of things going on, and we're talking about how to approach it with respect versus, you know, we're insulting or coming at someone. But for me, just engaging in this conversation, or just getting the infection control membership throughout the U.S. thinking about a new topic and thinking about, okay, I'm not going it alone. I don't have to bring this up in conversation and get attacked or get shut down or what have you. There are resources. There are data. There is all this that exists. Like, how can we work together collaboratively to do what Pete said, to drive change and to do no harm? And so I'm just excited. I'm thankful for this time, but I'm excited that hopefully some infection control leaders throughout the U.S. will say, hey, you know what? I haven't thought about this before. And guess what? I'm not going to go it alone. I'm going to get some help.
Everyone, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful discussion. And I suspect that it's not going to be the first. It might be the first, but it will not be the last of this discussion. And I appreciate your input, Peter Graves. Jill Holdsworth, sorry that you had to leave so quickly. Brenna Doran, yeah, Justin McKay. Thank you so much.